our job in education, I say this to teachers, I say this to students, our job in education, there's nothing more important we can do than get across the idea that the lives of children everywhere are worth the same. That the lives of, if we knew that, if we felt that, if we believed that, we could never have dropped the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We could never have done that, you know. We could never, never kill 200,000 people, old people, kids, all people living in two cities. We could never kill several hundred thousand of those people because we say, oh, well, we needed to do it to win the war. Actually, we didn't need to do it to win the war. I've done a lot of research on that, and I can assure you, no, we didn't need to do that to win the war. We may have had other motives in mind. Motives in which killing a couple hundred thousand people didn't matter so much as telling the world, we have these bombs, and don't forget it, really. You know, if somebody tells you, well, we had to do it, it's a shame. This is what they always say. Oh, we don't like the fact that we had to kill all these people. But, you know, we had to do it to win the war. To win the war faster, because we knew Japan had already lost the war, but to win it faster, we had to kill a couple hundred thousand people. Here's what you say to those people. I like to tell people what to say. Okay, here we are, August 1945. We could end the war more quickly by killing 100,000 American children. How about it? Would anybody say yes? No, I don't think so. Oh, well, but you're willing to kill 100,000 Japanese children to end the war quickly. What does that mean? It means that you don't consider Japanese children's lives as important as American lives. We have to get over that. We have to establish a principle in this world. We have to establish true globalization. You say, all people everywhere are the same. The Declaration of Independence promises equality and liberty, the right to pursue happiness for the people in the United States. It should promise it for people all over the world, you see. When I left the Air Force, I'm taking you through my life, month by month. Won't take long. I left the Air Force. I knocked around for a few years at terrible jobs, got married, had a few kids. I don't know how many. I decided to go to school, college, under the GI Bill, study history. Yeah. Well, just as I told you before, I knew by this time why I wanted to study history. I was interested in class. Conflict and class. I was interested in war because I had decided, even after participating in what was supposed to be called the Good War, World War II. You know, they keep showing us all these World War II movies, Saving Private Ryan, and you know, all these movies about the heroism of D-Day and the 101st and the 102nd, and so on. You know, yeah, the Good War. They're trying to take the aura of World War II, the Good War, and plaster it over every ugly war we have fought since then. That's what they're trying to do. I resent that. But I came out of the Good War thinking and coming to the conclusion that war solves no fundamental problems. It may seem to. It's like a quick fix. Oh, we got rid of Hitler. Oh, we got rid of Mussolini. Did we get rid of war? Did we get rid of fascism in the world? Did we get rid of racism or militarism in the world? Look at the world after we expended 50 million lives in that good war, and look at what the world is like after that, war after war after war. And people oppressed and people hungry all over the world. No, War is not a solution to any fundamental problems. That's the conclusion I came to. If we are going to do something about tyranny, yes, there are problems in the world, aggression, tyranny. We have to use the enormous ingenuity that human beings have. Now, we're very smart. We can build jet airplanes. We can send people to the moon. We can do computers. We're very smart and very dumb, right? But we have to use that smart part of us to figure out how to solve the social problems of the world without killing large numbers of people in war. That's our problem, you see. And, so I went to school under the GI Bill. And then I graduated. I got through that fast, right? Very quick, concentrated program. 2 minutes. Graduated, did graduate work, got a PhD, right? First teaching job, Spelman College, Atlanta, Georgia, a black women's college in Atlanta. Okay? So I spent 7 years, wife, kids, 7 years in Atlanta, Georgia, between 1956 and 1963. You know, time of the movement, what is called the civil rights movement, the black movement against racial segregation. And here I was teaching in a black college, women's college, we living in a black community. And of course, I had to get involved. I couldn't stay in the classroom while my students are out getting arrested, while students are demonstrating. My students would be out demonstrating, sitting in, and I would stay in the classroom and teach about liberty and democracy. You know, that was ridiculous. You know. So I joined them, I became involved, and I left Atlanta, went down to Albany, Georgia, where demonstrations were taking place. I went to Selma, Alabama, and Hattiesburg, Mississippi, and Jackson, and, that's what I did for the next several years. And I learned so much during those years, being involved in the movement, being involved with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC. I learned so much in those years. Well, for one thing, I learned to look at history from a black point of view. You know, history is different when you look at it from the point of view of black people. It's different when you look at it from the viewpoint of Native American people. Different when you look at it from the standpoint of women. It's just different, you know. And when you look at the history of from the point of view of black people, the heroes are different. even the names of eras turn out not to be quite accurate. You know, the progressive era, it's called. The first years of the 20th century, because some reforms were passed. Progressive era were those years in which more black people were lynched than in any other period in American history. You know, look at history from the standpoint of Indians. The Civil War, war for liberation. In the midst of the Civil War, more land is taken from the Indians out west than any comparable period in American history. Do you learn that when you learn about the Civil War? And I doubt it. But so I learned a lot about looking at history from different points of view. But probably the most important thing I learned was the power of ordinary people. Because racial segregation in the South was so deeply entrenched. Black people in the South seemed powerless. They had nobody in office. They had no policemen. They had no... All the people in power were white. And there was the white business structure. And not only that, but the federal government was in collaboration with the Southern segregationists maintaining racial segregation. A lot of people thought, you know, this was a common idea among Northerners. Oh, there's racism in the South and liberalism in the North. Not so. You know, the federal government... did not enforce for almost 100 years the 14th and 15th Amendments of the Constitution. For almost 100 years, every president of the United States violated his oath of office because the president pledges when he takes office that he will see to it that the laws are faithfully executed. The 14th Amendment, which equal protection of the laws, the 15th Amendment, right to vote regardless of race or color. The federal government, the president, did not enforce these laws for almost 100 years. And they did not become enforced until black people rose up, starting small, starting with some sit-ins in Greensboro, North Carolina, spreading to other states in the South, and the freedom rides, and then the demonstrations growing and growing and growing all over the South, and thousands and tens of thousands of people going to prison. And a commotion then created in the nation, a commotion which was then heard all over the country and around the world. And only then did the national government, only then did Congress finally come through and, you know, enact a Civil Rights Act and a Voting Rights Act. But what I learned was that people who apparently don't have any power and who apparently face enormous power, these powerless people have enormous power once they get together, once they organize, once they speak out, act out, set an example for others, and give courage to other people by what they do, and they persist, and they're willing to take risks, and they're willing to go to jail, and they're willing to get beaten, and some of them are going to get killed. But if they persist and persist, this great power that seems unbeatable will finally collapse. And that's what happened in the South. And the South changed. And that has happened in other places in this country where it seemed that, you know, they have the power and we can't do anything. In the 1930s, the Depression, working people, hard, hard time. And they decided to organize the workers of General Motors and Ford in order to get a little higher wage, shorter hours. And people said, you can't go up against General Motors. You can't go up against Ford. These are very powerful corporations, and they have the government on their side because the government is always on the side of the rich. I'm sorry to say that. It's embarrassing to say that. But it's true. Well, maybe not always. Occasionally, when people put up a big enough fuss and people put up enough pressure, the government finally will do something on behalf of poor people, which is what happened in the 1930s. But what happened is that the workers of Ford Motor Company, when they got together and they went out on strike, and the plants couldn't operate, it didn't matter how much power, how much money Henry Ford had. Eventually, he had to give in. Eventually, General Motors had to give in. You know, when the workers sat in the factories and wouldn't let the factories go on, the famous sit-down strikes of 1936, 1937. What I learned in the South was that powerless people have enormous power. What I learned was that you do little things that you think aren't going to go anywhere, that you think aren't going to have any effect. But if you keep doing them, you will soon find that other people are doing them too. And at certain points in history, all these thousands and thousands of little acts that take place, because people have faith and they continue, at a certain point in history, they all come together and you have a great social movement and something changes in society. And we've seen this happen, you see. And it's at that point that democracy comes alive. Democracy is not the Constitution. Democracy is not the three branches of government. It's not checks and balances. And no, that's not what democracy is. Not what your teacher puts on the blackboard in junior high school, this diagram of checks and balances and three branches of government. No, that's not democracy. Democracy comes alive when people organize, get together, when citizens with a common cause decide that they are going to do something about an injustice that is going on, or they're going to stop a war that is an immoral war, or when women decide that they've been maltreated enough and they want to be recognized, or when disabled people decide that they've been seen as invisible for too long and they finally commit civil disobedience and raise a ruckus, and then finally Congress passes a law that will give them some benefits. That's when democracy comes alive. So we have... So we have, that's our problem today. We have to bring democracy alive. We're actually on our way with its beginning. There are people all over this country, just like there are people sitting, you know, here in this room. I don't know how many of you are, 1,300, 1,400. Wherever you go in the country, I travel a lot, I go around the country. Wherever I go, however small the town, I mean, Los Angeles is not a small town, but you can go to Bozeman, Montana. I was in... Where was I? I never know where I am. I was in Kentucky. I was in a little town in Kentucky. I was in Moorhead, Kentucky. And there were 1,500, yeah, a group as large as this, 1,500 people in Moorhead, Kentucky in this auditorium. And I gave them a speech against the war. And they all gave me a terrific, terrific reception. I thought, wow. Yeah, there are people all over this country who really care, who don't want war, who want this to be a different kind of country, who want the enormous wealth of this country to be used to help people, not to kill people. There are people all over this country who want that. So we have the beginnings. You know, we have the beginnings of a great social movement. And it's up to all of us to participate, to do something. Find something very small. Find an organization in your community. Find some group that's doing something that you believe in. If you can't find such a group, invent one. but do something, you see. And if we all, if we all just keep on keeping on, things will change. We can actually change things. It's hard to believe that now. We can get rid of Bush. And we can create a social movement which will cause anyone who's in power, even some Democrat. We can have a movement which will cause anybody in power, even if they didn't intend it when they got into power, to begin to do the kinds of things that people want this country to do and have. So I leave you with that. Thank you very much. One thing. I just have to tell you this, okay? I don't like to be applauded. Only kidding. But, I want to say something about the use of the term un-American. I like the use of the term un-American. The term un-American assumes that the people who use it know what America is, or who America is, you see. And, the term American is one of those terms which is intended to befog our minds. You know, what is American and what is un-American and who represents America and who doesn't represent America? You mean if you criticize the government of the United States, you're criticizing America? No. Is Bush an American in the same sense that we are Americans? We are Americans as much as Bush is America. More. Right? I mean, I assume, there are these, abstractions, America, the country, and you hear, sometimes you will see on television these young guys going off to war, and a television reporter is talking to them, says, tell me, son, the young man, young woman, why are you going off? And the person says, well, I'm willing to serve my country. Country? No. You go to war, you're not serving your country. You're serving a small group of people who will profit from this war, not serving your country. You know, you're not serving America. America is not the government. You know, there's a distinction between the government and the country, between the government and the people of the country. And this goes back to the Declaration of Independence. The basic philosophy that is expressed in the Declaration of Independence is that governments are artificial creations set up by the people to ensure certain rights, equality, life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness. Governments are set up to do that. And when they don't do that, when governments become destructive of those ends, that's the language of the Declaration, then, again, according to the Declaration, is the duty of the people to alter or abolish the government. You see. The Declaration, the Declaration of Independence is a patriotic document, you say. And the idea that you're being unpatriotic when you criticize the government means that you don't understand what democracy is. You don't understand the distinction between the government and the country. We who oppose war, we who criticize the government, we stand for the interests of the people in the country. We stand for the principles of the Declaration of Independence. That is patriotic.
Historian Howard Zinn speaking last November in Los Angeles. Thanks to Mansour Sabah and the LA Sound Posse for the recording and audio production on this tape. Visit lasoundposse.org to find out how everyone can participate in the development of a democratic media. You're listening to Unwelcome Guests on WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR, Knoxville. We'll conclude the program with our next installment of the book, Disciplined Minds, A Critical Look at Salaried Professionals and the Soul-Battering System That Shapes Their Lives, by Jeff Schmidt, published in the year 2000. This week, the conclusion of Chapter 15, on surviving professional training with your values intact. For those just joining the show, the central idea of Disciplined Minds is to show that professional work has a political component, and that the training and vetting procedures that are part of professional training and credentialing have an agenda beyond the teaching of technical skills such as physics, medicine, or law. Professional training is designed to produce graduates who will have what author Jeff Schmidt describes as a narrow focus, the willingness to use their technical skills in the service of the status quo while suspending their personal values, ethics, and aspirations for society. Schmidt's book was inspired in part by his own experiences as a physics graduate student, and we begin with the next subsection that deals with his own case. He wrote, "I managed to get through graduate school with my non-mainstream attitude and values mostly intact. I will describe some of that experience as an example of how one graduate student handled the inevitable conflict. When I arrived at the physics department at the University of California, Irvine, I found fearful and stressed out graduate students and a generally repressive atmosphere. I knew that if I adopted the favored mainstream behavior, even as a disingenuous act, my thinking would slowly and insidiously become more and more mainstream as well. As an undergraduate campus activist, I had seen how students who sat out the struggles of the day slowly became more and more conservative. So I decided to fake the favored attitude, but not the favored behavior. I would behave in accord with my real beliefs whenever I could get away with it. I decided to lie low at first so the faculty would pass me on the physics PhD qualifying examination. I didn't want them to look at my test papers and quote-unquote find that I didn't know enough physics. So before the test, I limited my participation in campus life to writing a few op-ed articles in the student newspaper. I knew that physics faculty members would disagree with the radical point of view that I took in these articles. But I also knew that if I chose topics far from the world of physics, the liberal professors would see the articles simply as a nice exercise of free speech by one of their students, who, after all, had the proper subordinate attitude where it counted, within the physics department. I also signed on with a faculty member and started collaborating with him on a research project, my dissertation project, so that I might have an advocate at exam evaluation time. After they passed me on the exam, I knew it would be more difficult for them to find an excuse to get rid of me, so I slowly increased my political activity. Another physics graduate student and I organized an unofficial science and society seminar in the department, focusing mainly on the politics of science. We brought in progressive faculty members from other departments, or gave talks ourselves, to stimulate lunchtime discussions, which attracted undergraduate and graduate students and occasionally faculty members. Eventually, I encouraged students from physics and other departments to form a local chapter of the activist organization Science for the People. Our group was strong and sponsored a number of study groups and well-attended events that allowed a radical point of view to be heard on controversial issues as diverse as sociobiology, faculty military research, and U.S. foreign intervention. Many of our actions hit close to home in the physics department, which we used as a base of operations in part because many of our members were physics students. The faculty knew I was one of the organizers, but they had to be careful because the mere existence of the organization constituted a threat that any repressive action on their part would be publicized and would mobilize people against them. In one of our many actions, we confronted the head of the Los Alamos Nuclear Weapons Laboratory when he spoke on campus before a large audience at a colloquium sponsored by the physics department. Harold Agnew, then director of the New Mexico Laboratory, had been invited to campus by his friend Frederick Raines, an Irvine physics professor who had worked on the hydrogen bomb at Los Alamos. Agnew had been a strong advocate of developing the neutron bomb, a nuclear weapon capable of killing people inside buildings while leaving the buildings perfectly intact. He had explained to a Senate subcommittee what the bomb would do to a person. In a very short time, he would become very ill and would be incapacitated. In a day or so, he would be dead. Close quote. When Agnew took questions after his talk, we demanded that he explain why, as the head of a supposedly politically neutral science laboratory, he had assigned what he described as a, quote, very elite group of scientists to lobby, quote, very aggressively in favor of the neutron bomb. He refused to give details. Later, at the beginning of the post-colloquium wine and cheese reception for him, I and others questioned him in an unfriendly way about the morality of his nuclear weapons work. Agnew lost his temper, and Raines had to hustle him out of the room. Raines was extremely embarrassed by our violation of the protocol for how to treat the director of a national laboratory, and he was furious with me in particular for leading the attack. As a member of the Los Alamos Old Boys Network and a big-time grantsman, Raines had a lot of power within the physics department. Faculty members were afraid to challenge him even though they didn't think he was particularly good at physics. Raines' anger was of more than academic concern to me because he paid my salary as a research assistant. Raines had agreed to allocate a tiny chunk of money from one of his multi-million dollar Department of Energy research contracts to finance a small project directed by my dissertation advisor, Riley Newman, and my salary was paid out of that. But Raines limited his retribution to a verbal attack against me at the next meeting of his research group. Another incident involving our organization hit the faculty closer to home. One of Raines' own graduate students, Scott Nakamura, suffered a fatal cerebral hemorrhage while working in one of Raines' laboratories. Scott was from a working-class family in Hawaii and had gone much farther in school than anyone else in his family. His many friends and fellow Science for the People members knew that it would mean a lot to Scott's parents if the department were to recognize his 8 years of graduate work by awarding his Ph.D. posthumously. When another student and I approached Raines with the suggestion, he rejected it out of hand, explaining that the Ph.D. is the, quote, coin of the realm and must not be devalued. The department issued a master's degree instead, but we argued to no avail that that represented only the first 2 or 3 years of Scott's graduate work. So we circulated a petition which forced the chairman of the physics department to appoint a committee, chaired by Raines, to decide the matter. Raines was furious, as were the department chairman and the other senior faculty members, that the petitioners had not accepted Raines' initial decision as final and were drawing ever wider attention to a denial that made the department look cold-hearted. The committee invited the students to testify under the icy glare of its chairman and ended up issuing Scott a C. Phil, which ranks between a master's degree and a Ph.D. The senior faculty members, angry that their authority had been successfully challenged, moved to discipline the graduate students involved. Each student was punished in some way and warned by his dissertation advisor that if he wanted to get his own degree, he should mind his own business and concentrate on his work. My advisor, Riley Newman, happened to be in Oxford, England, on a sabbatical leave at the time this all happened. And so the department handled my case somewhat differently. They saw me as a more dedicated opponent than the other students involved and clearly wanted me out. But by then I was only a couple of months from completing my dissertation, and so the only practical way to get rid of me, ironically, was to help me finish it. In Newman's absence, physics professor Jonas Schultz had been checking the chapters of my dissertation as I completed them. Schultz had always been rather slow to respond, but suddenly and mysteriously, my dissertation seemed to become his highest priority. One Friday, Schultz told me that Raines had phoned from Los Alamos to ask if my dissertation would be typed by Monday. Schultz knew that many weeks' worth of work remained to be done, and so told Raines regretfully that his suggestion was impractical. When Monday came around, Raines tried to take possession of my dissertation from my typist. He wanted to put two typists to work on it simultaneously to give me a Ph.D. and get me out of the department without my advisor even seeing the dissertation. But the typist, his former secretary, whom he was paying to do the job, knew about my conflict with him and refused to hand it over. I finished it 6 weeks later. At the same time, without Newman's approval, Raines fired me, taking me off the payroll as a research assistant. I claimed this was retaliation for exercising free speech, and after I completed the degree, I demanded 6 weeks' pay, because standard practice in Raines' research group had been to employ students until they completed their degrees. When my advisor returned from sabbatical and asked Raines about my dismissal, Raines told him in a voice of finality, "He can have his vacation pay, but that's all." This was a small concession, Because department practice was to cheat research assistants out of their vacations by asking them to report vacation days on their month's timesheets without actually taking any time off. 7 physics graduate students wrote a letter to the department chairman supporting me, and when I mentioned the dispute to the head of the faculty union, mathematics professor Joel Westman, he offered to take up my case. It was highly unusual, of course, for the faculty union to take a case against a faculty member, but the union didn't want to see any university employee fired for political activity. Raines at first rebuffed Westman, but then capitulated and asked Newman, "What do I have to do to settle this?" Newman told him the amount I had calculated, and Raines paid up. I donated the money to the faculty union. My history of troublemaking didn't interfere with my getting a job after graduation. By the time word of it got to my boss at Physics Today magazine, which had hired me as an associate editor, I was already through the probationary period and was again busy making trouble for managers who deserved it. The one who belatedly outed my bad attitude to the Physics Today management was Irvine physics professor Gregory Benford, a plasma physicist with military connections discussed in Chapter 5, whose attempt to join my dissertation committee I had blocked. In a telephone conversation that I learned about accidentally, Benford spelled out my political beliefs to my very interested boss, Gloria B. Lubkin, then editor of Physics Today. He also gave her details about my political activities. Lubkin put this information into my personnel matters file in her office. Example, quote, "He believes in revolution in all countries," close quote. The notion that in the United States an employee's political views are not a personnel matter is, of course, only a pretense. As we have seen, the boss's high priority on control over the workforce and control over the political content of the work requires them to be concerned about the attitudes and values of their employees. I oppose political dossiers on employees not because their content is so often inaccurate, but because their content often is accurate and facilitates this control. Files and finks, however, rarely change the final outcome of conflicts. The amount of solidarity or potential solidarity is the determining factor. Yes, people who favor the status quo tend to get treated better than their less conservative colleagues. However, at the same time, people willing to take a stand often get treated better than people with a butt-kissing attitude, who often get taken advantage of. Hence, for example, despite my radical views, as a student and then as a working professional, I have found myself harassed and exploited less than other students and co-workers. The faculty and bosses have treated me with greater respect, gotten on my case much less frequently, given me greater autonomy, and accepted less work from me, making my daily life much less stressful. They tend to do the most to those who will take the most. And I'm reading from Disciplined Minds, A Critical Look at Salaried Professionals and the Soul-Battering System that Shapes Their Lives by Jeff Schmidt, published in the year 2000. And continuing on to the conclusion of Chapter 15, this is the next subcaption titled Individual Violence. Most people don't expect professional training programs at institutions of higher education to be the scene of cold-blooded murder. They are naive. When they think of professional training, they probably think of kindly bearded professors conveying important knowledge to eager young students. They don't think of institutions attempting to break students into a lifetime of political subordination, or of institutions holding students' futures hostage to encourage them to get with the program. The stakes in professional education are clearly high enough that grievances can lead to violence. The chance of violence is increased when the students in a university department have no independent organization to fight for power within the department. Then students have no way to lessen the fear and isolation that pervades so many programs. The power gained through organizing reduces insecurity, the source of the fear. The fight itself builds solidarity, reducing the cutthroat competition that is the source of the isolation. And the organization can represent individuals with grievances. But without an independent organization, students who feel unjustly treated must either swallow the injustice or take on those with power alone. As a result, there is enough violence that some weeks parts of the Chronicle of Higher Education are reminiscent of big city tabloids. Wayne State professor gunned down in class, read one recent headline on an article reporting that yet another graduate student had killed his doctoral advisor. Students who carry out deadly violence don't all have the same depth of understanding of their problem's origins. Thus, the violence follows all of the possible patterns: suicide, killing, suicide, and killing. A brief look at one example of each shows how at least three students perceived the issues. Jason Altum killed himself on the 15th of August, 1998. He was the fourth chemistry graduate student at Harvard University to commit suicide since 1981. Altum was considered the top graduate student in the research group headed by his advisor, Nobel Prize winner Elias J. Corey, a prominent chemist known for his work on the synthesis of organic molecules. Nevertheless, in a handwritten letter that he left behind, Altum blamed his suicide on Corey and the system that fails to protect graduate students from abusive research advisors. Indeed, Corey's relationship to Altum resembled that of a cult leader to a member. Like a cult leader, Corey was both revered and feared. Revered for his chemistry, and feared for his ability to make or break the careers of his graduate students. To Altum, Corey was, quote, like God, said one chemistry graduate student, a friend of Altum's. The only opinion about chemistry that mattered to Jason was Corey's, said another. Throughout the department, students commonly worked with religious fervor, toiling late into the night, 7 days a week. In many research groups, no amount of work was seen as sufficient. Thus, some students tried to create the illusion that they were always around. By leaving the lights on in their labs, by leaving a decoy coat out in a prominent spot, by keeping a magnetic stirrer spinning in a beaker of liquid. Altum often worked 13 or more hours per day, always scrambling to come up with something new to say to Corey, who was checking on his progress twice a day. Professors here have too much power over the lives of their graduate students, wrote Altum, who was almost 27 years old and had devoted 5 years of his life to graduate school in preparation for an academic job. To have a chance of success in the looming, highly competitive academic job market, Altum needed Corey's full support. But some harsh criticism from Corey convinced Altum that such support was not in the cards. Altum's suicide helped push the chemistry department to accept a student proposal that slightly diluted the power of advisors over their students. Now students can ask two additional faculty members to play a small advisory role. The professors who run the department had rejected the same proposal 3 years earlier. But those in charge still don't want fundamental change. In a telling effort to have their cake and eat it too, that is, to avoid violent attrition without fundamentally changing their stress-inducing approach to education, The professors arranged to offer their graduate students psychiatric help off-campus and at department expense. Yes, the Harvard Chemistry Department now has its own on-call psychiatrist. Gang Lu killed his physics dissertation advisor on November 1, 1991, along with three other physicists, a university administrator, and himself. The physics faculty at the University of Iowa considered Lu to be among the top five graduate students ever to enroll in their department, which has a worldwide reputation in space physics research. Lu dispatched each of his pre-selected targets with execution-style gunshots to the head, without speaking a word about what he was doing. However, the night before the shootings, Lu wrote a goodbye letter to his sister and composed a long public statement in which he discussed his personal history, his 6 years as a physics graduate student, and each of the people he killed the next day. The unreferenced quotes below are from those writings. Lu's advisor, space physics theorist Christoph E. Gertz, drove his graduate student research assistants relentlessly. Lu was a hard worker, but Gertz, a NASA grantsman, thought he wasn't working hard enough. Gertz got on Lu's case and began pushing him by piling on the work and making spot checks on him in his office. Lu felt that Gertz exploited his research assistants, and Lu didn't hide his views from others in the department. Gertz could be extremely tough on students whom he perceived as lagging, and so his students competed for his favor. Lin Hua Shan, another outstanding student in Gertz's group, beat Lu in this competition by working longer hours, by frequently soliciting Gertz's advice, and by better concealing his own very real dislike for Gertz. I've been honest and frank for my whole life, and I've suffered for being that kind of person, said Lu, who saw Shan as a butt-kisser. I have most of all detested cunning, fawning sycophants and dishonest bureaucrats. Shan was one of the physicists whom Lu killed. After the killings, one graduate student in the department was brave enough to say that if Gertz hadn't pressured Lu and Shan so much, the two might have had a different, less competitive relationship. But they did compete, and Gertz ended up showing favoritism towards Shan. This left Lu feeling targeted for mistreatment in both small and big ways. When one of Lu's calculations didn't turn out as Gertz had expected, Gertz immediately assumed that Lu had made a mistake. This upset Lu, especially when it turned out that Gertz was the one who had made a mistake. For the typical student, the defense of dissertation is just a ritual because the professors on the student's dissertation committee have already read the dissertation and brought any concerns to the student's attention. At Lu's dissertation defense, however, professors raised new questions, and they did so in a way that humiliated Lu. The department chairman was particularly harsh. To address the committee's new questions, Lu had to work day and night for a week redoing calculations, only to find that his results were right in the first place. Lu was hoping to win a university prize for his dissertation, but he discovered accidentally that the department chairman had consulted with the faculty and decided which student to nominate 2.5 months before the contest deadline, before all of Lu's committee members had seen his completed dissertation. The prize went to Shan, the favored student. Lu appealed the chairman's procedure to university officials but was repeatedly rebuffed. At every level, the investigation of Lu's complaint consisted of a university official talking to the physics department chairman and getting his assurance that the department had given Lu's dissertation fair consideration. Lu felt that the department wasn't enthusiastic about helping him get a job, and that Gertz wouldn't write good letters of recommendation for him. Gertz heard about Lou's concerns and insisted on writing the letters, but then missed several deadlines, invalidating Lou's job applications. Thus, at age 28, and after 10 years of intense undergraduate and graduate study, Lou had no job prospects. Lou's sister holds the university responsible for the 6 deaths. One of her insights about her brother certainly applies to many other aspiring scholars who have taken violent action, and to many who haven't. Because he devoted his entire being to his studies, as the university demanded, blocking his way was tantamount to destroying him. Thus Lou destroyed the people whom he felt had destroyed him. Usually an ordinary individual is too weak, both politically and financially, to oppose a giant organization, observed Lou. There exists no justice for little people. But guns make every person equal, he noted. Extraordinary action has to be taken to preserve this world as a better place to live. Close quote. So on an overcast November day, Lou made his way to room 309, a windowless seminar room in Van Allen Hall. James Van Allen himself, the renowned space physicist whose name is also attached to the Earth's radiation belts, sat in his office up on the 7th floor. Lou took a seat and waited for the regular Friday afternoon meeting of the Space Physics Theory Group to begin. About 10 minutes into the session, with the physicist at the chalkboard giving a talk, Lou stood up and, to everyone's surprise, pulled out a gun and shot Gertz, Shahn, and Robert Allen Smith, another member of Lou's dissertation committee. Lou then walked down to the 2nd floor and killed Dwight R. Nicholson, the physics department chairman. Lou's final stop was the administration building, where he killed T. Ann Clary, the associate vice chancellor for academic affairs, who was the highest level administrator, to reject Lou's dissertation prize appeal. Lou then killed himself. Theodore Strelesky murdered Stanford University mathematics professor Carol DeLue on August 18, 1978. At the time of the murder, Strelesky was in his 16th year as a graduate student in Stanford's mathematics department, an experience that had left him feeling disrespected and ripped off. From the beginning, attending the prestigious private school had been a financial struggle for Strelesky, who had very little money. Early on, he says he was told by DeLue that he would have to give up his part-time job at Lockheed Corporation while studying at Stanford. But the department didn't give Strelesky any financial support, and so he had to attend Stanford intermittently between low-paying jobs. Strelesky was socially naive. He didn't play the games that would have ingratiated him with the department. Honest and straightforward, he thought he would be rewarded simply for achieving the technical mastery of mathematics required by the department. So he was disillusioned when, after passing the qualifying examination, the department still didn't offer him financial support. He felt that DeLue didn't even take his inquiry seriously. Relegated to permanent outsider status, Strelesky had a difficult time finding a thesis advisor, and he suffered a series of casual put-downs by DeLue, from whom he took 7 mathematics courses. These seemingly minor incidents alarmed Strelesky, because they indicated that he didn't have the professorial favor needed to get good letters of recommendation or even to be awarded a Ph.D. Thus, after years of sacrifice and slavish study, it was becoming apparent to Strelesky that he would have no future in mathematics, the field to which he had devoted his life. Moreover, his marriage collapsed under the financial and academic pressure, which transformed him from a gentle person into a sometimes violent one. Stanford had left him with nothing, and with nothing to lose. The turning point came when an abstract of Strelesky's discoveries in mathematics was deemed publishable, a sign to him that his troubles were the result not of his failings as a mathematician, but of the department's abusiveness. It was time to act. Furious about the years of unfair treatment, he was willing to pay any price to be able to badmouth Stanford and do it with some impact. He considered going to the alumni, the students, or the media, but he felt he had no standing. The media don't cover struggling graduate students, he noted, but they do cover murders. Of course, one should take issue with this reasoning, but more social means of fighting back are unlikely to look feasible to socially isolated individuals like Strelesky. Because different people respond to frustration in different ways, some violently. Institutional injustice makes violence inevitable. Strelesky decided to target the professor whom he felt had done the most to block his career and his life. He envisioned the killing both as a real and as a symbolic act of self-defense against an individual and an institution that had virtually destroyed him. He brought a 2-pound sledgehammer to campus, found DeLu in his office grading exams, and bashed him on the head. Strelesky then turned himself in to the police. He maintained that the killing was a morally correct action and a political statement about the way Stanford treats its graduate students. After his arrest, Strelesky refused to submit to psychiatric examination, and he pressured his court-appointed lawyer into entering a simple not guilty plea instead of the not guilty by reason of insanity plea that the lawyer wanted to use. Strelesky considered that the Stanford math faculty had to be arrogant and powerful, and so he also made his lawyer agree to put them on the witness stand as a way of putting them on the spot. Strelesky took the stand himself and testified about his reasons for killing DeLu. In the end, the jury was unable to see Strelesky as an inherently bad person, and so convicted him of second-degree murder rather than first-degree murder. Although the prosecutor was outraged, calling the verdict almost illegal, Strelesky got a short sentence, which prison officials made even shorter by awarding him time off for good behavior. Ironically, it was only in prison that Strelesky was finally able to devote all of his attention to mathematics, just as his wealthy or financially supported fellow students had been able to do at Stanford. Thus, he described prison as a utopia with constraints and joked that he had a tenured position with a state institution. To the distress of many, Strelesky achieved his goal of criticizing Stanford with some impact. He got wide media coverage, including a sympathetic profile in People magazine and a guest appearance on Phil Donahue's show. Imprisoned for 7 years and 20 days, Strelesky has been a free man since September 8, 1985. And I've been reading from Disciplined Minds, a critical look at salaried professionals and the soul-battering system that shapes their lives by Jeff Schmidt, published in the year 2000 by Roman and Littlefield. That was the conclusion of Chapter 15, Surviving Professional Training with Your Values Intact. And in our next reading, we will begin the book's final chapter. If you'd like more information about the book or its author, Jeff Schmidt, or to find out how to obtain the book, visit www.disciplinedminds.com. And to contact us on the program or to download previous shows with readings of Disciplined Minds or any of the other material we've broadcast from our MP3 archive, visit unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thanks for listening.